Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, maintaining and operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for nearly 50 years.
Rural Alaskans have always paid high prices for energy, but the ongoing standoff between the U.S. and Iran means prices could be as much as 50% higher right when communities are ordering summer fuel shipments. Why does foreign oil affect Alaska's energy price, and what would the extra expense mean for rural and urban economies? That's our discussion today on Talk of Alaska.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
Good morning from Alaska Public Media. It's Talk of Alaska. I'm Wesley Early. Earlier in April, the Northern Journal reported that gas and heating fuel in Ambler, that's a village in northwest Alaska, has been $17.50 a gallon for the past year. A little near there in Kotzebue, it's $7.99 a gallon. Over in southeast in Petersburg, it's about $4.99. On the road system west of Fairbanks, it's $5.09. Western Alaska, Bethel's got $6.67 for gas and $7.19 for diesel. And now many rural communities are ordering annual fuel supplies, and the price outlook is pretty dire. Here to help break down the complicated system of fuel delivery schedules and why prices are predicted to be so high is Nils Andreasen. Nils is the executive director of the Alaska Municipal League. It's an organization that provides support services to 165 communities and boroughs across the state. Nils, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We also have in the studio Professor Kevin Berry. Is it Dr. Berry?
It's Dr. Berry.
Yeah. So I will not call you Mr. Berry. Professor Berry teaches economics at UAA. He's the chair of the university's Department of Economics and Public Policy. Welcome to you as well.
Thanks for having me.
So, Nils, you recently spoke to the House Energy Committee down in Juneau. A lot of concern was expressed from House Speaker Bryce Edgman of Dillingham and Representative Nellie Jimmy of Tuxedo Bay. Before you and Kevin sort of delve into the layers here, can you give us the main points that you brought to those communities last Thursday?
Yeah, thanks. I mean, I think that what we've said is what our members have told us, that they regularly make bulk fuel purchases. They do that during this time span. They're getting ready for the summer barge season. They're putting together budgets. And we had numerous reports from our members who said the wholesale price that they're being quoted 1 week was $4 and the next week was $7. And that triggered a lot of alarm. We've had reports from members who said they have to come up with an additional $1.2 million just to cover that cost. And that doesn't avoid the costs that are passed on to consumers. So that's warning signs for us all to consider. And that's what we brought to House Energy, that clearly there's a problem. And we're hearing more and more about it getting worse, including that fuel might not be available further into the summer.
Yeah, you know, many communities only get like one annual fuel delivery. What does this mean in terms of like purchase price and then for community and resident and business prices?
Yeah, that's prices are locked in. I think it's just so different than the rest of the nation or globe in a lot of ways. What we see in rural Alaska is you get one shot at this. You are likely monitoring those wholesale prices along the way, not just for transportation fuel, but also for heating fuel. You're monitoring those prices. You get one shot at hopefully choosing the lowest price you can get during that time frame, and it locks that price in for the rest of the year. Once that fuel is delivered, there's not an economy of scale and a transportation methodology to get new shipments later in the year. So price is really sticky in rural Alaska. Once it's there for the year, it stays. And often it doesn't rebound quickly even in over the coming years. It sticks around. So we know that high costs are pervasive. And it's just going to get worse this coming year and potentially years to come.
And I'm curious, like, and I understand each community must be different, but like even like a 30-cent change in fuel price, like what's sort of the trade-off if a community's waiting for maybe something to go a little lower, or if it's like keeps going up, like, you know, do you have a rough estimate of like, you know, what's 10 cents to a community for like their one shipment?
Yeah. I think, you know, it's not the cents that matter. I mean, we're talking about dollars mattering at this point, which is just so different than, I mean, I'm here in Juneau and we're talking about cents increases. They're looking at dollar increases. Everything costs more. And it's not just that the fuel costs more. It's the fuel to get the fuel to a community costs more. There's a trickle-down effect from once fuel gets there to all the transportation in a community costing more, all the supply chain, all the groceries costing more, and ultimately all the services being delivered cost more. So at every layer, there's a cost increase where 10 cents means a dollar and where a dollar means $3. And I think that's really what we'll be struggling with over this coming period of months.
How do we get here, right? Like, describe the two sort of pain points in the Middle East for us right now that are leading to these prices going up.
Sure. There was two main events that really drove the increase in oil prices. The first one, of course, was when the United States went to war with Iran. So that immediately drove up the price of oil because of uncertainty in the region. There were some direct attacks on things like oil infrastructure by sort of both sides in that conflict. And then the second part is the closure of the Strait of Hormuz too. So something like 20% of world energy supplies move through the Strait. And so that constraint means that, or that change really means that there was a steep decline in the supply of available oil globally. And so we operate in a global commodity market for oil, and it doesn't really matter if the shock is here or it's overseas or it's where it is, because those markets are really well integrated. And so that has then since been working through oil markets, and this shock has hit first in Southeast Asia, it started to hit Europe, and it's made its way to the United States too, as we've seen physical shortages of energy and ramp-ups in price in response to those shortages as people try and bid up and be able to purchase the supplies that are available.
So you mentioned refineries. For those who aren't super familiar, can you describe how they work and how they're set up for different types of fuel?
I'd probably make every engineer on the planet mad if I did, but the idea is pretty straightforward, right? We have to take crude oil and turn it into consumer products. And so there's sort of this ongoing chemistry set process that happens. And depending on what type of oil and where it comes from, you use slightly different processes to churn out different products. And so I don't know the exact process being an economist, but it means that as those supplies of crude oil from the Middle East decline, there's going to be changes in the availability of everything from avgas to regular unleaded to diesel to everything in between that comes from oil at the same time. And some of those refineries are located in different places and depend upon different sources of oil, which is why we've seen this shock kind of propagate across the globe.
Yeah. And how has that shock sort of impacted not just sort of fuel, because as Nils was mentioning earlier, you know, fuel prices lead to grocery prices going up. Can we talk a little bit about how those shocks have sort of reverberated around the globe, not just fuel prices, but sort of wider impacts?
Absolutely. So like Nils said, right, everything that we consume has to be moved. And a lot of the products that we consume move multiple times across the globe. We're sort of a hub for logistics. But if we think about even salmon coming out of, say, Bristol Bay, and maybe shipped to Southeast Asia in order to be processed and shipped back to the United States to be consumed, that means you've got to pay for fuel. Right, moving that fish across the globe twice. On top of that, you've got to pay higher prices for heating and energy and everything else at every step of the process too, and everything becomes more expensive. So it just kind of compounds on itself every time we're moving something. As Alaskans, a lot of what we can import as far as food and other products has to be shipped up here, and those shipping costs go up when energy gets more expensive. And I'd be remiss to mention too that, of course, oil's not the only commodity that's impacted. We know the fertilizer markets as well are being impacted. And that means that food prices will potentially climb too.
So Nils, when communities are talking to their fuel providers, how much competition is there to source fuel prices from? You know, what kind of leverage do Alaska fuel providers have to negotiate prices on behalf of communities?
Yeah, I think it's fairly limited. We've heard from, companies like Vitus and Crowley. Maybe there are one or two others. It's a limited field. They're looking at a supply market that is mostly East Asia, maybe West Coast US. They're right now, I think the main concern that they have is less about, I mean, they're concerned about price and affordability, but supply is the big one. And that's where they're running into issues. I think what we heard in House Energy is that there's sufficient supply to meet demand for now. There's maybe potentially more concern later this summer for longer term contracts. So they're looking anywhere they can get it. And the further afield they go, potentially the higher cost they're going to bear. And I think the other point that they made is, so one, it is a limited landscape for who's delivering that fuel. And we're not just talking about to the Port of Anchorage, we're talking about to coastal communities, but also riverine. So those barges need to make it up rivers in time to be commensurate with water flow and depth and so on. So it's actually a pretty complex dance that they're anticipating between securing a supply and getting it to communities by the time they need it and within the physical constraints that they work within.
Yeah, and I think you noted earlier that the prices are in right now. What is sort of the range of pricing, and when do you think those deliveries are going to start?
I think it's, so I mentioned from $4 to $7. I think that's about what, it's 50 to 100% is the numbers that are out there, I think. And it depends on how much fuel you're purchasing. If you belong to a cooperative or a bulk, a larger kind of collective purchasers, maybe you're able to get to a lower dollar point. Kotzebue is getting a lower dollar point than in-river communities. So you have to think about kind of every layer of distance adds cost. And that's pretty true across Alaska. But it also, I mean, I think what we heard from Vitus in their testimony is that the companies in their purchases can only expend so much. So they've got limited capital too, and they need to make sure that they're paid prior to delivery so that they can purchase more in their process. But this occurs over the course of the summer. I think it's by August generally that most fuel deliveries need to have been made. So June, July, August, there's kind of these staging as rivers open up across the state.
Did you have something to add, Kevin?
I was just thinking as Nils was speaking too, one of the things to keep in mind with how much of these price increases are going to be passed off to people, to community members and communities, is something called elasticity, which is how responsive markets are, particularly demand. And if we're thinking about rural Alaska, as Nils mentioned before, once the price is in, it's kind of in. You can't wait and see if prices will decline. You have to ideally get your shipments in during the summer. Otherwise, you face much higher transportation costs over winter. And so there's not this ease of pushing purchases off. It means that we are kind of stuck with the price today. And on top of it, a lot of these communities don't have easy ways to shift away from petroleum, from oil products, right? There's not large budgets available to suddenly build different infrastructure and change the way that we operate. So there's really limited ways for communities to avoid price hikes. We kind of have to take them as they come, which is really difficult.
Yeah, and Nils, you were talking a bit about co-ops earlier, and I'm really curious how well-coordinated some of these deliveries are. You know, can you talk about how communities and local governments are working together to maybe get larger shipments as a collective group of communities to kind of save some money?
Yeah, I think the best example is something like the Alaska Village Electric Co-op, and they do, so they've got dozens of electric utilities that they own and manage. They're maintaining pretty sophisticated awareness of these fuel markets. School districts are another example of, you've got purchases for school districts that span communities. I think the Lake and Peninsula Borough is working right now on establishing some kind of bulk fuel purchasing. So it's happening in some places, it's nascent in others, and then it doesn't happen. And even within some communities, there are multiple purchasers of bulk fuel, the city, the tribe, the school district, each for different purposes, some for retail, some for their own needs. Denali Commission is working on a bulk fuel study that I wish were further along, or I hope is that we'll catch some traction here soon. But basically trying to answer this question, how do we make sure that the assets are functional and that systems are in place to deliver this fuel efficiently? And the more purchasers banding together, the better in so many ways.
And is this something that's kind of always been in place for some of these smaller communities? Are we seeing sort of more collaboration with communities as the price of oil kind of becomes more? I know that it's a very recent hike now because of the war in Iran. But, you know, oil prices, as anybody who follows state government, have been kind of all over the place recently.
Yeah, this isn't it's not new necessarily. There's been in the Ukraine war, you saw similar price spikes. What's new, what feels new this year is the unavailability of supply and that potential. So that's a real concern. I think communities have been working toward this for a long time. And Northwest Arctic Borough, we've seen good strides made. Lake and Penn, I mentioned. It happens differently in different regions. But I don't think we've come up with a clear answer for how to navigate trust and cost and liability in a way that offsets those concerns and allows everyone to work more collaboratively together. And that's something the state could help with. And we've talked about that in House Energy. Is there a role for the state to lower some of those barriers to cooperation?
Kevin, Nils was talking a lot about the fear of just not having enough supply. But, you know, when it comes down to cost, you know, if fuel does rise in price by 50%, you know, what does that mean for remote communities that you mentioned earlier? A lot of them kind of, they don't have alternatives.
I mean, it's a cost of living increase. It's a cost of operations increase. And so communities will be stuck either trying to figure out how to cover those costs or having to make different decisions. And so I think this is one of the really difficult situations where people may have to make, you know, decisions that they don't want to. They'll be driven to do it. And I think it's worth bringing up, right, we haven't seen shortages here necessarily, but globally we are seeing shortages. So part of what's driving prices up is that we are now bidding against the entire rest of the world for a shrinking supply of oil. And that supply is unlikely to increase in the near term either. So the Ukraine shock, for instance, was a little bit shorter term because it was driven by sanctions on Russian oil in response to their invasion. But this is also being driven by physical scarcity because some of the infrastructure in the Middle East has been destroyed or at least disabled for an extended period of time. So the other difference is when we look at futures prices today, this is also not a shock that's going away. Oil was trading at about 60 to 65 before the war began. It doesn't look, just looking at WTI oil prices, just looking at futures for WTI oil, we're not expected to get back to those numbers until at least the end of the decade. Right. So this is a long run shock that's going to increase costs potentially in rural Alaska and not go away. And the question is, like, how do you make that work without large capital expenditures to change the way that people fundamentally use energy and their overall energy demand?
Is that, you know, and I certainly wasn't alive when this happened, but, you know, we hear often about like the late 1970s where there were lines to get gas. It's like, is that the type of thing that we could be seeing? Is that the type of thing that's currently happening because of a supply shortage? And as Alaska kind of becomes more impacted by it, we could see up here?
So globally, a lot of other countries have already imposed sort of efforts to reduce fossil fuel or oil usage, right, and try and reduce consumer demand in order to respond to these shortages, particularly in lower income countries. Overall, the U.S. is still a very wealthy country, so we're more likely to just see price increases, particularly in the short to medium term, as we are buying up supplies from elsewhere. And again, a good chunk of this, too, is also that it's not that we were buying oil from the Middle East. It's that the overall global commodity market has a reduced supply now. So oil that we would have purchased before, other countries are now interested in buying as well, and they're competing with us on price. They're offering more and more in order to get that physical delivery.
So we produce a lot of oil in Alaska, but we don't have any refineries. Why is that? And how much would it help if we did have refining capacity here in Alaska? I guess I'll go to you, Kevin.
So a lot of it comes down to comparative advantage, right? If we're talking about large industrial processes, typically we ship almost every commodity out to be processed elsewhere because costs are lower elsewhere. But it really wouldn't make much of a difference if we had refining within Alaska. Because again, like the folks doing the refining would be seeking the highest price globally, which is what we want them to do, especially given so much of our state budget is driven by the price of oil. So we'd want them to sell at the highest price possible. And so that's going to be determined globally based on global demand and global supply. We are also not a large enough producer globally to really impact prices as long as we're still participating in a market that includes everyone else.
So we know that these prices are going to hit rural Alaska extra hard. I think the figure was like $17 in Ambler earlier. But, you know, Urban communities are also going to be impacted by this. Are there larger communities that are especially vulnerable? And if so, why? Nils, I'd like to go to you on that first.
I was actually going to add that when it comes to what the long lines question for, I think for rural communities in Alaska, they'll just run out of fuel, right? There won't be lines. They will have a fixed budget that they have to capital to purchase fuel. That has to last the season. If they don't have more capital, they will run out sooner than they have maybe in the past. So I think that's that already happens in some Alaska communities. And that's probably the bigger challenge that especially state officials should maybe be thinking about in terms of will we be declaring an increased number of fuel disasters, fuel emergencies this coming spring if there's a insufficiency of supply?
So how do, as we sort of move from rural communities to larger communities, Nils, are there communities in the state that are kind of bigger, your Anchorages, Fairbankses, Junos, that are especially vulnerable because of this shock to the system?
Yeah, I think it's less about the community as a whole, and it's going to be kind of micro level impact. So if you are a local government or a community with a transit system, your transits, your buses rely on fuel and fuel prices. So you'll see it there. If you have a large capital project, bridges, roads, buildings, anything, any kind of facility or surface transportation, those things will cost more. And you likely over the last few years applied for federal grants through the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. You had a set budget for what that would look like. You had a contingency built in, and the pricing now has been blown out the window. So we've already seen that occur in many, but you'll be left with trying to figure out how to fund the rest of a project that the federal or state funding that you were counting on is simply insufficient. So you'll see it translated into some of those more kind of specific impacts, and not all the community as a whole experiencing this price disruption. But the public sector especially is going to be bearing a lot of these costs, and that's going to trickle down into how contractors are delivering projects and how much they're able to get paid for those projects and so on.
Yeah, Kevin, anything to add?
Yeah, just also taking it from what Nils is talking about from the public sector perspective, we can also think about the household budget perspective too. And so Nils mentioned, for instance, public transit. So communities that have access to things like public transit or non-motorized transportation, right? Folks in like Anchorage who live on the trail system might be able to more easily avoid some of these cost impacts because they can do things like take the bus or ride their bike and do other things to avoid this higher cost. But I saw gas for $5.29 in Anchorage yesterday. And there's a lot of folks who do have to drive to work or who live in the valley and have to commute to Anchorage. And those are going to be direct, like, family budget impacts, at least in the short run. You know, when we think about how responsive markets are to these shocks, there's folks who have built sort of a life around, I drive from the Mat-Su to Anchorage, I drop my child off at daycare somewhere along the way, and I have to be at work at a certain time until a certain time. And they're not able to change their behavior, like, very short term. In the longer term, they can consider moving back to Anchorage from the Mat-Su or changing employment and working in the Mat-Su instead of commuting. They can buy an EV. They can carpool, do a lot of different things. But in the short run, we're going to see shocks directly to household budgets as people try and make this work too on an individual level. On top of, like Nils mentioned, some of the inflation effects where the cost of projects and everything else is going to go up on top of it.
Yeah, and I guess beyond the high price of gas, you know, where else do you expect urban Alaskans to sort of feel this price hike the most?
So far, shocks to natural gas have not been as extreme as the shocks to oil directly. But as we were talking about before, everything that comes up here has to be moved by fuel, and that fuel disproportionately comes from oil. And so we can potentially see this in food prices and other product prices too, as it potentially becomes a driver of inflation.
So one of the big topics the last few years with relation to energy has been the looming natural gas shortage in South Central Alaska. How much potential does the Iran conflict have to make that problem worse?
So I think that's a huge question mark, right? So the economics of LNG potentially get better potentially get better with a really big shock to energy markets. It maybe makes more sense to build a pipeline to export liquefied natural gas. And if that pipeline gets built, of course, that would drive a massive increase of supply for folks living on the rail belt, in particular in South Central. At the same time, if the pipeline doesn't get built, this can also potentially drive demand for LNG overseas, and we would be competing more with other countries for that supply to import it here, which would drive up energy prices. So it's really sort of uncertain. It depends. Sort of anything with energy prices, particularly in South Central, is like a big question mark on, well, if the LNG pipeline gets built, one thing happens. If it doesn't, we can expect something else.
And I guess from your perspective as an economist, you know, how does that pipeline pencil out right now?
You know, I'm not willing to say on the radio. I'll tell you sometime over a coffee. It's one of those things that there's a lot of unknowns for on a personal level. I'm not saying on the project overall.
Sure. We're going to take a quick break, but we will be back to have Talk of Alaska as we come back. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. I'm Wesley Early, and we're discussing high fuel prices today as a result of the war in Iran. My guests today are Nils Andreasen and Kevin Berry. So, Kevin, communities lost renewable energy momentum when federal money was shut off. What can communities do to help themselves make it through these elevated prices without that sort of federal money to help balance that out?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think similar to what we've been talking about throughout this segment, it really depends on where those communities are and what opportunities they have. So on an individual level, if you're in urban Alaska and you've got access to other forms of transportation, and you can think about work from home and shifting your lifestyle, you can maybe in the short run adapt. And in the medium and long run, people can make different choices about EVs or whatever. So in the longer run, we would expect people to be able to adapt to these price changes more. If you're in rural Alaska, you face sort of unique challenges because, as we've talked about, right, the price gets locked in and that is the price. And you have more limited options to change your lifestyle in response to higher energy prices. So more of it's going to come out of household budgets. And that's just going to be a tough choice for folks in those communities. And it may lead to more people moving out of those communities into urban Alaska instead. And I think that's something that's going to be important to watch. And it's also going to lead to, I think, increased calls, particularly with the more money coming into the state budget, for a larger PFD or an energy relief payment or something like that in order to help individuals sort of deal with those higher costs. Because in the short run, people are really stuck, and a lot of communities and municipal governments are going to be stuck as well with just a higher cost and not as many resources to cover them.
So you mentioned it earlier with sort of Mat-Su commuting, right? Like that's such a fixed it's a fixed requirement, right? If you're maybe less fixed now because of remote working, but you know, can you talk a little more about the pressures that communities face where people might be forced to relocate? You were talking about moving to more urban communities, but you know, I think of the Mat-Su as a fairly urban community compared to other parts, but even they aren't insulated. Even they need to move to more urban communities.
Well, yeah, I mean, a lot of it comes down to, right, the lifestyle people have. And of course, we all know it's very different between rural and urban Alaska. And so when we think about people moving to a lower cost community in rural Alaska, we may mean moving to a hub, right, and moving to a place with different economic opportunities and maybe a lower cost of energy. But it, like you just said, that same problem exists in what we think of as like urban Alaska between the Mat-Su and Anchorage. One of the key economic drivers in the Mat-Su Valley, of course, is proximity to Anchorage, where somebody can get maybe a larger house at lower cost and then commute into Anchorage every day. That deal looks pretty good when gas is about $3.29. That deal looks significantly worse when gas is $5.29. And it's only one gas station so far, but that's the direction gas prices have been moving in the last day or two. And so from that, I would expect, say, if I'm an employer or a municipal government, more of my employees who do commute are going to start asking about remote work, right? People are going to look for the easiest way to transition and avoid costs at first. And then over time, they may make, like you said, structural changes and start saying, why do I live, you know, an hour away from where I work? I can change either my job or my home.
And Nils, as sort of people are forced to relocate, you know, how do you see that impacting local business? You talked a lot about sort of the private sector. How do you see relocation impacting some of those businesses?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's so much of this that is a trickle out effect. I think about it. I mean, even to Kevin's points. People will start making different decisions, right? They will have choices that will be narrower the smaller community they get to, but it will mean fewer trips to the store. It will mean fewer visits to a restaurant if there's a restaurant in town. Businesses will start to feel that impact. Businesses will start to think about relocating. Those will be the kinds of conversations that individuals, households, businesses have over this coming year. And in rural Alaska, there's only so much you can do. You can conserve fuel, you can lower your heating costs. If it's a bad winter, those things become untenable. And moving to larger communities and from larger communities to even larger, those will come with consequences. That'll mean more services that those local governments or public service providers have to deliver. Schools will feel some impact. And we've already seen trends in school enrollment. So that will start to trickle out. I think there's so much to this that is connected to other aspects of Alaska's community, economic, kind of social systems, and kind of that larger looming question of net out-migration that has plagued Alaska for 13 years. People know that things cost more in Alaska, and it's worth it. At some point, it might not be for some Alaskans. And that will be, I think that's a policy conversation that the state will wrestle with over these coming weeks too.
Yeah, and I think about sort of the community features that maybe other small towns in the lower 48 don't have. You know, so many rural Alaska communities rely on things like subsistence. You know, they rely on things like it's their land. You know, it's not so much a right. I moved to this town because there was this job. You know, there's such a deep community cultural feel. Like, what are you hearing from communities as they sort of wrestle with these issues as to how basically how long they can afford to stay in their communities?
Yeah. Yeah, for so many Alaskans, it's not about choice, right? This is home. I do think there are increasingly kind of broader extended family networks across the state that people will leverage. And we have communities, residents displaced by Typhoon Halong who are not home and are working through that. So, I mean, I think you might see something like that, increased displacement, and probably many organizations and the state and others working through how do we correct for that? How do we support, provide technical assistance? How do we provide public assistance so that there's the ability to go home when there's a price correction, if and when that happens? We haven't been, right now we're not hearing about that from our members, but I know those are perennial topics. And if things get really bad, I think Speaker Edgemond said apocalyptic, you would expect those kinds of effects and consequences from this kind of price hike and supply disruption. So I think we should be prepared for those conversations and those eventualities over this next year and be working to mitigate or address them.
You know, and one thing, Kevin, I wanted to make sure I heard you right, that the current predictions for when the price of oil sort of globally is going to drop down is like a decade from now, you said? So these are going to kind of be long-term.
So about the end of the decade. So if you look just futures contracts up for WTI oil, we get back to around 65 by about 2030 based on futures contracts now. And some of that maybe that we are pricing in, for instance, an increase in supply as we move more back to normal. And some of that potentially is also just reductions in demand. And so one of the things that I think is also worth keeping on everybody's radar is as everybody globally makes these different decisions about how we consume energy, that's going to reduce demand for one of our main exports, if not like the main export. And that's going to lead to permanently lower potentially oil prices and less demand for oil too. And that is not necessarily great for the state of Alaska's budget. And there is sort of this divide between what's great for the state budget and what's great for Alaskans and even smaller communities individually too. That's sort of complicates the whole thing. I also should mention, I just got a note from my colleague, Brett Watson, that there are in fact three refineries in Alaska. So thanks, Brett, for listening.
We got an email from, it may have also been that there's one in Fairbanks, there's one in Valdez and one in Kenai, and they all refine state royalty oil. But it sounds like what you said earlier was that having more refineries wouldn't really change things because of just systems outside of the state.
Yeah, in the end, it's still a global commodity market. So it doesn't matter if it's refined here, California, or on the other side of the planet. In the end, those refiners are still going to seek to sell their oil at the world price, which is the highest price that they can sell at.
Nils, I'd like to shift to you on a couple programs that are sort of aimed to sort of offset fuel prices. There's one, the bulk fuel loan program. Can you walk me through how communities access those loans and how expensive they are and what kind of interest and fees they pay for them?
Yeah, so that that's a state-run program, the Bulk Fuel Revolving Loan Fund. And I mean, I think what that fund does is give local governments and eligible entities access to capital, right? So it's not lowering costs for consumers or even necessarily for local governments. It just ensures there's something to pay for that bulk fuel purchase when it's made. And actually, you know, Vitus and Crowley and others rely on that fund and get reimbursed from that for their deliveries of fuel. It's a low interest program, and there's varying kind of triggers at what interest rates look like. But I think in the range of from 1% to 3%, depending on whether you're a first time borrower or have utilized the program in the past. But it's an effective way. There's a cap on it, $750,000, which if you're in a community that now needs $1.2 million more than you needed last year is insufficient. That's something we've been asking to have addressed, to increase that cap. The cap is higher if you're purchasing collectively, but still doesn't address the needs that you'll see this year.
And that's to sort of offset what you were talking about before, where communities, it won't necessarily be that they see a lot of higher prices, but that they just run out because they didn't have enough capital in the first place to purchase.
It just makes sure that those communities have access to be able to purchase the fuel necessary at the cost that's available, at the price that's available.
And then, Nils, could you also remind us of how the power cost equalization program works? You know, who's eligible, and do you think that it's a large enough fund to help when prices are this high?
Yeah, that's so power cost equalization it recognizes that there is this disparity around the state, that the state has made massive investments into especially rail belt communities to ensure they've got access to energy. So power cost equalization established a fund, an endowment that's grown over the years. And what it does is reimburse rural households in the majority of communities, but not all, a portion of their experienced cost. And that difference is, there's kind of an average between Juneau, Fairbanks, and Anchorage and then whatever they're paying, that's the difference that PCE payments accommodate, and those go out to households. It's only households that are eligible, so it's not school districts, it's not local governments beyond a certain amount for community facilities, it's not commercial operations. So for all of them, the costs are still 100% of what their actuals are, but it does alleviate some of the pressure for households. Is it enough? I think Alaska Energy Authority came back to the legislature asking for more money to be able to meet the needs of rural Alaskans this year. They might need more. The fund in total is enough, but the fund is only able to spin off a certain amount of resources each year. So they might have to draw further on that or use general funds to offset that difference.
You know, one of the things I was curious about when Kevin brought up the sort of disconnect between, you know, high oil prices mean that Alaska's likely going to have a larger budget, but it's also going to mean individual Alaskans will have to pay more. I'm curious if there have been discussions at the legislature to use some of this short-term gains for things like power cost equalization, for some of these programs to, you know, essentially like understanding that communities are going to be hit by this and sort of offsetting that now that the state has a little more money to throw around.
Yeah, I think there's two level. There's been extreme interest, I think, from the legislature in helping to manage some of these higher costs. And it needs to happen at two levels. So keep your public sector whole so that they can keep communities whole and make sure that individual Alaskans households have access to the resources they need to manage those costs too. So the legislature has done a few things. The Senate's budget included a plus up for community assistance, which will help all local governments. There's been funding to school districts for their school transportation needs and bulk fuel purchases proposed. Those things are good to help the public sector. There is the energy relief check, I think, that's proposed. I think Kevin said it earlier, $125, $150. That's been larger in prior years. And it really just depends on how certain is the legislature of what prices are going to be this coming year, and what kind of due diligence do they need to do to make sure the state's budget is whole at the same time. So those are the things they're wrestling with in these final few weeks of this legislative session.
All right, well, we're going to go to the phones. We have Jason calling from Copper Valley. Jason, thanks so much for joining the show.
Thank you so much for taking my call. Two short court comments. One would be, of course, food to start with, a good time to start a garden. And just a little reminder on with the price of meat. Alaska does not have the protein mass to support the population. So any of the hillbillies that think they're just going to go out and shoot a moose to solve the problem are confused. And they're going to be surprised because there won't be any moose. We only have moose because we have a very well-managed population by fish and game. The second one, would this be a really good time to open up the question about light rail, as in Anchorage can't absorb the population, the working population of the valley, and the valley can't really absorb the offset of, you know, populations changing places. But light rail would step us into the 21st century as a progressive region. So those are my two comments. Thank you very much for taking the call, and yeah, stay safe.
Well, thanks so much, Jason, for calling. And, you know, taking the comment about gardens aside, you know, one of the things I'm really, because I've done coverage about, you know, the prospect of having sort of a train between Anchorage and the Valley. And there's a big discussion over like federal money, like so much of that stuff requires so much upfront capital. Kevin, can you talk a little about the prospect for, can you talk at all about prospect for light rail?
If I can first, I want to address Jason's first point, which is, well, there may not be enough moose. I intend to catch enough salmon this year that I'll be fine. And I'm betting everybody else will. Actually, one of my other veins of or sort of interest research-wise involves personal use fishing. And I'm really curious what we'll see as households try and mitigate the impacts on their budgets by going out and catching more fish this year. If we'll see higher participation, for instance, in dip net fisheries and other opportunities. But Jason, that's a bet, and I'll take it, that I can catch enough protein. But I do think, you know, that some of these other shocks that are hopefully short term maybe change some of the ridership that we would see from like light rail right now, which is one of the driving problems of building rail lines in South Central Alaska, right, that there wouldn't be enough daily commuters to really fill it. The other part, too, is the other economic challenge is once somebody gets, say, from the Mat-Su to Anchorage, Anchorage itself is so physically spread out that we'd need also a larger investment in public transit and probably in the valley as well, so on both sides. You can maybe do park and ride on one side, but you'd need a station that drops people off reasonably close to where they work or an additional like bus system that can deliver them close to where they work at a reasonable frequency too. So there is really a lot more on the cost side when it comes to commuter rail that I think often gets discussed that still makes that a challenge just based on sort of the physical built environment in the Anchorage area. That's hard to deal with without addressing just a lot of other policy issues all at the same time.
Yeah, it strikes me that like, you know, the best time to build light rail would have been in like the 80s when just the state was flush with cash. We're going to keep up with the phones. We have Hannah in Wrangell calling in. Hannah, thanks so much for joining the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
What would you like to discuss?
Yeah, so I live in Wrangell, which is located in Southeast, and everything that we receive, like our groceries and everything, comes via barge, which I think is why we generally have higher food prices than, I guess, we think about Juneau or Ketchikan. And we just received notice from our barge supplier here that we are going to be having a temporary fuel increase or fuel surcharge of about 6%, and it could go up to 9%. So we're going to see increased costs at our groceries based on kind of everything that's going on with the price of fuel at this point.
Yeah. Nils, I'd like to turn to you on that. You know, what are you hearing about a community? I've heard some Southwest Alaska communities like near Accutan and the Aleutians have had to see, they've seen fuel surcharges. Is this something you're seeing commonly across members?
Yeah, I think we'll see that across transportation systems. So shipping and barge companies have already moved in that direction. I would expect airlines, if they haven't already, to do something similar. It's really hard to overcome the tyranny of distance and geography in Alaska. I'm sure Kevin wrestles with economy of scale and all the things from an economics perspective too, but it's really, really challenging to make things pencil out here. And I think that's true for light rail too. We can build anything. The federal government could make an investment and construct something. They're basing their decisions on a benefit cost analysis that mostly says it won't pencil out. And when it does, the question becomes, can we afford it? And we look at that for water and wastewater systems. The state evaluates whether water and wastewater systems are affordable at the end of the day. And there's a reason we still have communities that don't have water and wastewater, because it doesn't. That's it's a challenge that Alaskans always face, and higher fuel costs right now really puts pain into that conversation.
All right, we're going to take another short break, but we'll be back as Talk of Alaska continues. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. I'm Wesley Early, and we're talking about high fuel prices and their effects on rural and urban communities. Our guests today are Nils Andreasen with the Alaska Municipal League and UAA Economics Department Chair Dr. Kevin Berry. We got an email shortly before the break from Chris in Homer. He says, could you remind us about exporting Alaska oil? When oil production first started on the North Slope and piped to Valdez, was that oil prevented from being exported into the international market? What year did it change that this oil could be put on the international market, and how has this affected our local Alaska oil and gas supply?
So this is a great history test. So I know in the past there have been limitations on foreign exports, and I don't know off the top of my head when exactly those were lifted, but that's sort of an interesting trade-off. So if we banned the export of oil from Alaska, for instance, that would mean that we get a dramatically lower price for that oil, right? So that would be the intent of banning that export. If we do that, the state budget is suddenly in crisis. We could expect that we'd be producing at much lower prices. We would not be getting the $100 a barrel we are getting, you know, roughly for right now for Alaskan crude. And that would be catastrophe. We'd be talking about major cuts to public safety budgets, education budgets, everything else. And so I think that this is one of the topics that's been on my mind, which is a button that one could press if we wanted to drive prices down, would be to try and restrict exports again. But that would hit Alaska from the other direction. We'd go back to having massive budget deficits almost overnight. And that is a different world. That's also a challenge. And I think it's worth us all keeping in mind through this crisis that there's not really a world that's costless. Alaska faces a unique trade-off as a state, no matter what happens.
Yeah, Alaska would have to have a lot more different revenue sources to sort of have that pencil out. We've got another caller in. Sandy from Talkeetna joins the show. Sandy, thanks so much.
Thank you for taking my call. I appreciate it. I live in a small community like some of the other callers, and the discussion here touched on what this sort of thing is doing to small communities, possibly draining populations, making people move. That whole conversation about people moving to bigger communities really, really got under my fingernails. These are our homes. These communities are vibrant. And they are good places to live and raise children and be involved in your community. I would like us not to lose sight of the fact that this was caused by a war, this particular go-around. Not that we haven't had this happen before. And so we need to pressure our legislators to not go along down this path with the leadership of this country. It has been squarely on their backs that our delegation has just knuckled under every single place they can possibly knuckle under. And ultimately, if you think about it, Alaska is uniquely poised to be independent in the sense that if we were not so dependent on oil. And as you said, the price of oil bumping up our revenues, et cetera, we're sort of the devil in both directions. If we had spent more time developing our alternatives and making those things work, we wouldn't be crunched like this. We would be smiling and saying, sorry, guys, in the lower 48, I'm sorry you didn't figure this out, but we did. But we're not there yet. And there's a lot of reasons we're not there, and most of it's politics. So I'm going to leave it at that. That's my comments.
Well, thanks so much for calling, Sandy. And, you know, she touches on something that, you know, Kevin was just talking about, where because Alaska doesn't have a diversified economy, a very diversified economy, you know, it kind of leans in that if we wanted to sort of preserve some of this Alaska oil for ourselves, it would result in just budget catastrophe. But Nils, you know, she brought up, Sandy brought up the question of lawmakers and what they can do about this. And, you know, the legislative session is starting to wind down. We've got a couple minutes left, but, you know, from your perspective, what do you want lawmakers to do to address this issue?
Yeah. Well, first I want to recognize too, I mean, her point about this being home, right? We have cultural and historical ties to our communities. There's an economic reality where jobs are place-based, whether that's fishing, or oil and gas development, mining, or subsistence activities. And we've got a public policy commitment. Both the U.S. and Alaska have long said that communities deserve to exist where they are. So from a state lawmaker perspective, the question is, how do we help them do that, right? So how do we mitigate the negative impacts of these price increases in some kind of meaningful way? We presented to House Energy a number of potential options. We already talked about the bulk fuel revolving loan fund. The state does have a very small motor fuel tax of 8 cents. That's something they could pause collection of. It wouldn't break the bank at the state level. They could waive some fees in other. We talked about public transit earlier. They could waive some of the fees that they take off in the transfer of funds to nonprofits and local governments and tribes for those. They could invest in the heating assistance program, the state's version of LIHEAP, low-income heating energy assistance program, the AHFC's home weatherization program. There's a lot of tools they have. Almost all of them require them to defer money or spend money. Those will be questions that the budget committees, finance committees take up in these final few weeks. And they need to be a resource, right? Provide communities some kind of technical assistance so that they can call and help navigate through this challenging time.
All right. And Kevin, we have just about a minute left. So how would you save the state?
Yeah. So I think first to acknowledge Sandy's point, right? This is a cost of the war, and it's a really large cost, like Nils pointed out, that this is something that people are going to have to bear, even if it doesn't go through a cash register, if they're forced to make these difficult choices. But the other part of this is, in response to both her comments and Nils, that a lot of this is still driven by the same structural deficit that we have as a state, because we do not pay a statewide sales tax or a statewide income tax. We provide a permanent fund dividend at some level, and we still expect service levels. And so, you know, we were reaching this point where we were discussing taxes before the shock happened. I think in the long run, the solution remains some sort of broad-based tax if we're going to break this disconnect and be more resilient to these shocks in the future.
All right. Well, a great discussion today on Talk of Alaska on fuel prices in rural Alaska communities as a result of the war in Iran. I want to thank all of our callers. I'd like to thank our audio engineer, Crystal Hyde. Emily Messner was our producer, and Tobin Shelby was monitoring our phones today. I'm Wesley Early, and this has been Talk of Alaska. Also, thanking our guests, Dr. Kevin Berry from the University of Alaska Anchorage and Nils Andreasen with the Alaska Municipal League. This has been Talk of Alaska.
Talk of Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.